Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming to learn together. So we're going to do a, like we always do, we'll raise two or three shailas, and you'll tell me which one you would like to speak about, and we'll speak about that shaila. So one shaila I got is from a Talmud of mine. It's a post-Purim shaila. He sent me a picture of his Purim costume, and his Purim costume was a large jumpsuit that was fully covered with Thank You Hashem, the Thank You Hashem insignia. You know what this looks like, right? The yellow circle insignia with a crown on it, and it says in big letters, Thank You Hashem. So it says all over his large jumpsuit, Thank You Hashem. And he wrote to me as follows, he voice noted me, Shalom Aleichem Rabbi, I hope all is well. I wore this costume on Purim. I'm sorry that I didn't make it to North Windmere. It was a very busy with the kids, but I did visit one rabbi who told me, you know, you really can't wear this jumpsuit in the bathroom. Now, obviously, I don't wear Thank You Hashem jumpsuits every day. Every day is not Purim, but there is a lot of such gear, you know, shirts, hats. They have, I don't know if you're familiar with the entire Thank You Hashem movement, but they have, well, actually, those who are doing the fly-in, George mentioned that you'll be meeting with Rabbi Yossi Zakatinsky, who's, you know, a major figure in the Thank You Hashem movement. But anyway, so someone told him, you know, you really can't wear such things in the bathroom. He said they have all kinds of gear like this, you know, gear that says Hashem Hu HaMelech. So he said, is it true that you're not allowed to wear something that says the word Hashem on it in the bathroom? So that is shaila number one. Shaila number two I got from a 7-year-old girl in my shul. She has a toothpaste that she uses every morning called Kids Crest Color Changing Toothpaste. The way it works is, or the idea of it is that in order to encourage children to spend more time brushing their teeth and not to just brush their teeth for like 10 seconds, if you brush your teeth with this toothpaste for 2 minutes, it changes from blue to pink. And that's a way to encourage children to brush their teeth properly, to brush for 2 minutes. So this 7-year-old girl, it occurred to her that if she brushes her teeth on Shabbos using her color-changing toothpaste, that it might be a problem. So she wanted to know if she's allowed to use her color-changing toothpaste on Shabbos. That is shaila number two. Should we do a third one? Mention a third one and then take a vote? Yeah, no? Yeah. Do a third one. Okay. Third shaila. A woman in my shul has a favorite chicken recipe that she always makes for her family. At least once a week, she said she makes this recipe. The recipe includes chicken and a dressing that's poured over the chicken, and then breading, which is held onto the chicken through the dressing. And she was recently in the supermarket, and she noticed the dressing that she always uses for this chicken recipe had a big blue sticker on it, and it said dairy. And she was disappointed to learn that the dressing that she always used for her chicken had now become dairy. And she wondered why they would change the recipe for it. When she went home, she looked in her fridge at the bottle of dressing that she had, and there was no big blue sticker on it that said dairy, but she looked a little closer at the label, and it said OUD. And she realized, uh-oh, it's likely they didn't change the recipe. It's just that I never realized that the chicken I've been making all these years is dairy. So she looked at the ingredient panel. Maybe it's one of those OUD things. It's really just dairy equipment or isn't, right? So she looked at the ingredient panel, and the ingredients included skim milk. So her next thought was, okay, but maybe it's just a trace amount of skim milk. Maybe it's batel b'shishim or something like that. And you know how on ingredients it sometimes says less than 2% of. So this was the last ingredient right before the less than 2% of. So it means that it's more than 2% of the dressing is skim milk. Now, you don't have to be a whiz at math to realize that if it's more than 2%, it is not batel b'shishim. So now she realizes that for years she's been using a dressing that is dairy on her chicken, and it's been made in every pot in her kitchen. It's been put on every plate in her kitchen. It's been used with every fork and every knife in her kitchen. So her shaila is, what do I have to do now? Are all my dishes treif? Is there a way to kasha them? Do I need to throw them out? Are all my Are all my Pyrexes that I use in the oven, are all they treif? Is the dishwasher treif? What do I do now, realizing that that this dressing that she uses is in fact dairy? So again, three shilas. Shila number one was wearing thank you Hashem jumpsuits in the bathroom. Shila number two is using color changing toothpaste on Shabbos. And shila number three, the chicken and milk recipe for disaster. So all those who want to vote on the chat over here, which Shaila 3 1 3 3 3 3. All right, looks like everyone wants three. Wow. Okay, everyone wants three except for George. Okay, we'll have to cover the thank you Hashem one some other time, I guess. Okay, so I guess we're going to talk about the chicken and milk recipe. So let's talk about that a little bit. Okay, now. The first thing to look at is there any chance that maybe the chicken wasn't really treif, right? I mean, the first matter of business is to clarify whether there was bittel of the milk. Because, you know, if actual milk falls into my chicken soup still might be kosher as long as I have shishim in the chicken soup connected to the milk. So if I have a dressing that has a little bit of milk in it and that goes into my chicken, I don't know, maybe it becomes batel b'shishim. So there are two ways that bittel could happen. First way it could happen is if the milk becomes batel in the dressing itself. The problem is, as we said, this particular dressing had more than 2% was made up of this milk. So I called the OU who gives Ashkacha on this dressing, and I spoke to or I emailed Rabbi Gersten, who is the expert on everything in the OU. He's a tremendous resource for the Jewish community. One of the it's better that not everybody knows about him. The rabbis bother him enough. He probably doesn't need everybody in the world bothering him, but he knows everything about kashrus and everything that goes on at the OU. And Rabbi Gersten said, you know, oftentimes when they list skim milk as an ingredient in something like a salad dressing, they don't actually put in skim milk. What they do is they put in they have milk powder that they then hydrate, turn back into milk, and put that in. Meaning they don't work with pure skim milk. They work with a milk powder that they then turn back into milk and put that in the dressing. So he says it could be, and that they would list it as more than 2% if the reconstituted skim milk is more than 2%. But the milk powder itself is less than 2%. So there's a chance that there might still be bittel b'shishim in the dressing if you hold that the way we measure the shishim, I hope I'm being clear about this, that the way we measure the shishim is based on the milk powder and not based on the reconstituted skim milk. Because reconstituted skim milk is essentially, I have milk powder, which is a dairy ingredient, and then I add water to that, which is my own addition, that's my own parv ingredient that I'm adding. So maybe I shouldn't count that water that I'm adding. I should just count the milk powder, and then it should be batel b'shishim. So he said, if it's milk powder, then there's what to talk about. And Rabbi Gersten said that both Rav Eliashiv and Rav Belsky, Zichronam Livracha, held that you only need to measure shishim against the milk powder. You don't need to measure shishim against the reconstituted milk. Now, when Rabbi Gerson said to me that both Rav Eliashiv and Rav Belsky held that way, I knew that there was a very good chance that Rav Schechter does not hold that way, because Rabbi Gerson's job in the OU is he's the recorder of psak of the OU poskim, so he knows every single psak halacha from Rav Belsky and Rav Schechter from all the years. So when he dafka didn't say that Rav Schechter holds that way, I knew we were in trouble. So I went over to Rav Schechter in the base medrash and I said, you know, it says more than 2% milk. He said, that's a problem, so it's not batel. I said, yeah, but it might just be milk powder that's reconstituted. He said, so what? Reconstituted means that it's all milk, that they turned it back into skim milk. So then you have to measure against the whole thing. So Rav Schechter confirmed for me, he didn't even think it was a havamina to only measure against the milk powder. But anyway, as it turns out, that was not helpful anyway, because the OU reached out to the company and the company got back to them that they actually just use fresh skim milk. They do not use milk powder at all. They use fresh skim milk. So our first attempt at bittel to be able to make this whole problem go away was not successful. So there's another way that bittul could happen. Sometimes bittul could happen not just in the salad dressing, but maybe if only a small percentage of the dressing has milk, and then you mix the dressing with the chicken, maybe between the rest of the dressing and the chicken, it's shishim keneged the milk, and maybe that should make the milk batel. So it seems very likely that there's more than shishim in the chicken against the milk. Meaning, if that dressing would have been dropped into, you know, a few drops of that dressing would have been poured into a pot of chicken soup, it would for sure be batel. Because let's say you have 3% of the dressing is milk, and then between the other 97% of the dressing plus all the chicken soup, it would for sure be shishim against the milk. So what about in chicken, when you pour it on chicken? So that idea of bittul b'shishim would only work if the chicken is in a sauce or in a liquid form. But if you're baking chicken dry, then there's another set of rules. That set of rules is what we call tzli rather than bishul. There's a Mishnah Maseches Chulin Daf Tzadi Vav that says Yerach shenisbashul ba giranosha im yesh ba benosin tam harezu asura. And the Gemara comments, working with the opinion that a giranosha is able to give tam, that it's only if it's nisbashel that you can that we make that assumption. But if it's nitzle, if it's roasted, it's fine because the tam doesn't transfer too far away when it's roasted. So when it's roasted, we assume when something is dry heat, we assume that the tam transfers only a little bit, only to the immediate vicinity, and not much further than that. And therefore, in this case with the chicken, we assume that the dressing does not get evenly dispersed throughout all the chicken. If it's sitting on top of the chicken and then you roast it or you bake it, the tam of that dressing goes right into that outer layer of chicken and does not become batel. The Mechaber Paskins in Shulchan Aruch that Isser ben Cham ben Kar Shenafal al Atzli She'etz al Ha'esh, if something falls on something that is hot and roasting and dry, Eino Osel Kedein it impacts the thickness of a finger within the chicken. So there you can't rely that you have shishim in such a small amount of the chicken, and therefore we have to assume that the product that she used is dairy, it's mixing with chicken, and it's becoming basar b'chalav, and it's therefore trafing everything up. So now we know we don't have an easy solution, now we have to figure out where do we go from here. Right, this is where this is where learning Yerideya is very helpful, because this is why rabbis have to learn Yerideya. Most of the time you get shilas in the kitchen. I always tell the Talmidim in yeshiva that 99% of the time you get a shila from a kosher kitchen, the answer is that it's fine unless there was an onion involved. That's you could get all of smicha. 99% of smicha is it's kosher unless there was an onion involved. But over here, this is where we really this is the other 1% of the time where even without an onion involved, someone actually had a milk product mixing with chicken. So now we need to talk about how do you kasher everything, and does everything need to be kashered? So let's first start with what the chicken goes in first. It goes into a Pyrex dish, and that's where it is baked, in a Pyrex dish. Now Pyrex is glass. Whether glass is boleya, whether glass absorbs anything, is a machlokas rishonim. There are basically three shitos, really four, but basically three shitos in rishonim, and they're all brought in Shulchan Aruch. One opinion of Rishonim is that glass is boleya just like cheres is boleya, just like pottery is boleya, in the sense that it's boleya, it absorbs the tam, it absorbs taste, and you can never get that taste out. There's no way to kasher it. Meaning that glass is the very worst thing to treif up, because it becomes treif, and there's no way to kasher it. A second opinion in Rishonim is that no, glass is just like metal. Where do we get that idea that glass is just like metal? Because the Gemara says that when it comes to tevilas kelim, the Rabbanan treat glass like metal. That just like you have to be tovel metal kelim, so glass has something in common with metal, namely that if metal breaks, you can heat it up and fix it in that way. Glass, you could do the same with, and therefore glass is treated like metal. What's the halacha when it comes to metal kelim? Well, it absorbs tam, but it can also be kashered. So there is a shita in Rishonim that you're able to kasher glass kelim. That yes, it becomes treif, but you can also kasher it. And then there's a third shita in Rishonim that glass is not balea at all. That there glass, and this is the one that this shita actually most conforms to the metzias, to the actual reality of the scientific reality, that glass does not absorb anything. And therefore, you can use glass for milchik, fleishig, Pesach, the rest of the year, that it wouldn't be any problem at all. So the Ramah says that, let's put it this way, let's start with Svardim. Svardim have it much easier over here. Svardim will use the same glass dishes for milchik, for fleishig, for everything. It doesn't, they assume that glass cannot become trafed up, that glass is like that third sheet of the most lenient of all the sheetos. In fact, I just got the shayla yesterday. Someone said to me that there's two guys that are roommates together. One of them is a Sephardic guy, one of them is an Ashkenazi guy. So he wants to know how careful does he have to be with the glass utensils, knowing that the Ashkenazi roommate may want to use those glass dishes as well. So can the Sephardi guy go with his tradition and use it for milchik, for fleishik, to cook milchik, to cook fleishik, do all those things? One of the young rabbanim in the yeshiva told me that his in-laws are Ashkenazi. He's a young Sephardic rav in the yeshiva, and he said that he had his in-laws over for dinner one night, and they were eating off of their glass plates, and they were eating chicken, and he realized, ay vey, less than 24 hours ago, we were just eating pizza off of these plates. And my in-laws are Ashkenazim. So he right away said, wait, don't use these plates. When he first got married, he married an Ashkenazi girl, he said, I'm going to do something that's going to make your life so much easier. And he presented her with glass dishes. Because now she doesn't have to think about what's milchig, what's fleishig, how you wash it, what dishwasher. Doesn't matter, it's all glass. And if you're Sephardic, that's perfectly fine. But if you're an Ashkenazi, that's a real problem. Ashkenazim go in the other extreme. We are most machmir about glass. We treat it like cheres. We treat it like something that can absorb and that cannot be kashered. So if that's the case, every Pyrex that this woman used in baking this chicken, because she is Ashkenazi, she can give to a Sephardic friend of hers, or she can throw out. There's no other option as far as I see it. In terms of the Pyrex dishes. There are poskim that are makel b'shas hadchak, or when it's a hefsid meruba, to rely on kashering glass, to rely on those opinions that hold that you, the middle ground opinion, that you are allowed to kasher glass. Rav Shechta says that b'makom hefsid meruba, if you're going to kasher glass, you should do it three times, aligned with the shita of the Bala Iter, that cheres can even be kashered if you do it three times, if you do agala three times. I don't know, it didn't seem like such a shasad chak. By the time I spoke to the woman, she had already thrown out all the Pyrex dishes. That's another thing you discover as a rabbi, that the as machmir as you would ever be, the typical frum woman who's running a kitchen in her home is way more machmir. So by the time I spoke to her, she had already, burnt down her entire kitchen and redone it. You know, it was like there was not exactly, but I'm saying she had clearly moved on and decided that that things have to change. So that's as far as the glass Pyrex dishes. What about china? What about the china dishes that they eat off of? So Rabbi Yaakov Emden holds that glazed china is not balea because it's just like glass, which he assumes is not balea. You know, Rav Palm once had a shayla with a newlywed who, with a new kala, had put hot chicken straight onto a glazed milchik serving plate. And the person came, the young man came to Rav Palm, and he asked him, what's the halacha about this expensive serving plate we just got as a wedding gift, that it was a milchik serving plate that my wife put hot chicken straight onto this glazed china dish, this very expensive glazed china dish. So Rav Palm said, wait a second, your family, your parents, davened by Rav Bik. And the guy said, yeah. So he said, so don't ask me the Shaila, go to Rav Bik, ask Rav Bik the Shaila, which was very strange, because Rapam is perfectly capable of paskening a simple Yaradeya Shaila. He taught Yaradeya in Tarvadas. So, and he learned Yaradeya quite well. He knew Yaradeya backwards and forwards. So it was a little bit strange that he sent the Shaila to Rav Bik. So Rapam explained to his Talmidim that Rav Bik was an enikel of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And even though Rav Pam himself didn't hold this way, he knew that Rav Bik did hold this way, because he was an enikel of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that since it's glazed china, that you can assume it doesn't become treif. So for a young kala to tell her that she treifed up this expensive dish, he didn't want to take that upon himself to create some sort of shalom bayis problem or disappointment for a young kala. So the person actually did daven by Rav Bik, so he was comfortable sending him to Rav Bik. Now, in Siman Taf Nun Aleph, I guess it's good to talk about Hechsher Kalim now. We're within Shloshim Yom of Hilchas Pesach, Pesach. So you're supposed to be talking about Hilchas Pesach, even though nowadays no one kashers anything anymore. Everyone just has separate dishes. But it used to be a thing. It used to be. You'd go to the big place where they kasher things, and you'd kasher everything. Now we just, the only things we kasher are like our ovens and our sinks and things like that. We don't actually, most people don't kasher dishes anymore. But this is traditionally the time that we learn about Hechsher Kalim. So, and that's where it appears, by the way, in Shulchan Aruch. Hechsher Kalim appears in two places in Shulchan Aruch. One place where you'd expect it, in Yerideya, where we talk about all of the Chaskashras, and the other place is in Aruch Chaim, in Hilchos Pesach, because that's where it comes up. That's where practically it comes up. So in Siman Taf Nun Aleph, it says that if you have glazed china, it has a din of cheres, and the Mishabru over there in Sivkot and Kuflam and Zayin says that even though the Mechaber holds that glass is not paleya, since when it's connected to cheres, it makes it much worse. So even according to the Mechaber, who's makel of glass, we have to be machmir with glazed china. So unless you're a Rav Bik or Rav Yaakov Emden person, you'd have to be machmir in the china. Now, the tzad lahakel by the china is that the china is a klisheni, so there's much more room to be makel on a klisheni. However, common practice is that we treat a solid hot food that's more than yatzo ledesbo, that's placed on a klisheni, we treat that as a kli rishon. It's what's called dover gush. That a dover gush is treated as a kli rishon. So that's as far as the china. What about the actual cutlery? What about the forks and the knives that they use? So the Mishnah Maseches Avodah Zarah tells us that the basic rule when it comes to kashering kelim is kibolo kach polto. The same way a kli absorbs flavor, that's the way it emits flavor as well. But a kli can only absorb flavor if the contents of that it comes in, the food that it comes in contact with, are hot beyond yad soledisbo. So if your pot accidentally becomes non-kosher when milk fell into a meat stew and the stew is already yad soledisbo, you need to kasher the pot using hagala, by dipping it in boiling water. But if your meat skewer became non-kosher because you accidentally grilled pork with it, I don't know how that would happen accidentally, or you fried meat in a dairy pan, much more common, then the way to kasher that is through libum, through blowtorching it, because that's a higher level of heat with which it absorbed. So when it comes to forks and knives, we typically assume that since it did not come in contact with the hot food directly over a fire, it only came in contact with the hot food on your plate, so we assume that the way to kasher it is hagala. How do we do hagala? So the Rama writes that the practice is that ein lahagil shum kli kol zman shu ben yomo. That one thing you want to make sure is you wait until 24 hours have passed before you kasher a kli. And the reason for that is that when you put a treif of kli into a big pot of boiling water, the bleios of treif come out of that kli and they go into the water. Now, if those are problematic bleos of treif that go into the water, it will treif up the whole water. And then the water will treif up the kli again, so you will not have accomplished anything. But by waiting 24 hours, you're ensuring that whatever tam is still in the kli is what's called tam lufgam. It's a tam that doesn't have a positive taste to it. So when it goes out into the water, it becomes batel in the water because it's already a tam pagum, and therefore it's not going to turn around and treif up your kli again. So after 24 hours have passed, and you make sure the kli is absolutely clean, you heat up a large pot of water and you put the non-kosher utensils in the water. The Rama adds that you should also make sure that the water is at a constant rolling boil for the Hagala to be valid. If the water is not boiling, then the Hagala is invalid. A lot of times in industrial kashrus, they need to kashrut things and they can't wait 24 hours. So what they'll do is they'll put in a davar apogim. They'll pour in some ammonia into the water in order to make sure that whatever time comes out becomes pogum right away. The problem with that is, Rabbi Reisman often points out, is that the boiling point of water is lower or higher than the boiling point of the bleach or the ammonia. So what will often happen is they'll put in this bleach into the water, the bleach will burn out, and it will just be pure water. The water will not be burnt out. The bleach will burn out and the water will still be there, and people will assume that it's pogim because you have bleach there, but you don't have bleach there. Rabbi Reisman said he once walked into a kitchen in a hotel where they were kashering, and he saw that this is what they were doing. They weren't waiting 24 hours. They were just pouring, they were just relying on bleach that they had poured into the solution. And he said, give me a cup. So they said, what do you need a cup for? He said, I'm going to drink some of the water. They said, you can't drink that water. You're going to die if you drink that water. There's bleach in there. He said, oh yeah, watch this. And he took and he drank the water. And he said it was perfectly fine. The bleach had already burnt out. He saw that the mashkiach wasn't careful to keep on pouring more in and to make sure that it hadn't burnt out. So a person has to really know what they're doing if they're relying on things like that. But a simple kashering of forks and knives is actually pretty easy. What made this case so complicated is that typically, when you're dealing with something that gets strafed up in the kitchen, it's a thing. It's a fork, a knife, a pot. Over here, it's every fork, every knife, every pot. And the reason for that is because this was something that was happening over and over and over and over again over the course of years. So you have to assume that everything became trafed. So it's a big hassle, but it's the kind of thing that that a person has to do. Now, are there any tzadim lahakel over here? So one tzad lahakel is, like we said, that a kli sheni is not boleya. So maybe that will help for the plates, that it's already in a kli sheni. It might even help for the forks and the knives, that by the time the fork and the knife came in contact with the chicken, it was already in a kli sheni. Another tzad lahakel is that the Bala Iter holds that Agala Gimel Pamim works, Rav Shachter pointed out, if you do it in three separate pots. That if you do Agala three times, even on a kli cheres, it could be that that works. Another tzad lahakel, something else to think about as a potential point lahakel, is that the Chacham Tzvi holds that after 12 months, all blios are gone, that the blios just disappear, which is a big chiddush. But he says, if we assume that after 24 hours, the blia, the absorption of tam in the kli becomes tam pagum, becomes distasteful, so probably it continues to degenerate over time. And probably by the end of 12 months, it's no longer there at all. So even though we don't generally accept the Chacham Tzvi, but there's what we call a sniff lahakel, that it's at least a consideration when thinking about this. Another possible tzad lahakel is what we pointed out, that the glaze on the china might make it a glass kli, which isn't boleya. So if the china were in fact very, very expensive china, I would think that there is that there's room to be makil to do agala three times on each piece of china. Now, as it turned out, this story has kind of a happy ending. Well, one happy ending is that we were able to inform people that work in kashrus, and they were able to send around to all the rabbanim, please remind everybody to check labels before making any assumptions. And they sent a picture and they told this horror story, and it was able to hopefully inspire people, and particularly around Pesach time. It's very, very important. A lot of times you go to a supermarket and you see, oh, there's a kosher for Passover section. So you think everything is kosher for Passover. The guy stocking the shelves may not be super duper careful every time and might make a mistake. I remember once many years ago when our kids were very, very young, we were at a relative on Pesach, on Yantif, and the relative had Pesach cereal. And my brother was with us, and my brother said, this Pesach cereal looks really good for Pesach cereal. It was one of these from brands, Bloomy's Pesach cereal or something like that. And he's like, this looks really good for Pesach cereal. And let me look at the ingredients. And he saw right there, first ingredient, cornstarch. And he said, cornstarch? That's kidneys. That can't be a Pesach cereal. Then he kept reading the ingredients. Next ingredient, wheat flour. Wheat flour? That's chametz. did you know that these Frum brands also make cereal year-round? And the person stocking the Pesach shelves just took the chametz stick of cereal and accidentally put it. It's very, very important to check labels. The other positive that came out of this, the reason it wasn't so bad in the end, was that the woman had said that she really only makes this chicken recipe during the week, never on Shabbos, because it gets dried out on Shabbos. It's only good when it's fresh. So she only makes it during the week. And during the week, they never use dishes. They always use paper plates. She said she'd be surprised if they ever used real dishes with this. Certainly, obviously, never their Shabbos dishes, but she thinks not even their weekday dishes. So forks and knives are the only thing that really, and the Pyrexes, but the Pyrexes she had already thrown out by the time she even called me. So that wasn't even, wasn't my problem. That was already taken care of. So all that she ended up really having to do is koshering the forks and the knives, and that solved the problem. Now, obviously, one should feel terribly about that because, you know, it means that they were eating non-kosher food for a very long time, for many years, and there's a concept called Timtum Alev and other things that aren't good. But nevertheless, at least going forward, it was not that difficult to kosher everything in order to make her kitchen kosher once again. Okay.